and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, the King of Norway speaks alongside a panel of Arctic experts. King Harald V traveled to Alaska for 2 days last week. He spoke to the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on the 27th at the Dena'ina Center. This hour, you'll also hear from Governor Walker's Arctic advisor, Craig Fleener. Fleener is followed by Harald Steen, the director of the Center for Ice, Climate, and Ecosystems at the Norwegian Polar Institute. And lastly, you'll hear from Børge Usland, a polar adventurer and explorer, also from Norway. U.S. Arctic Research Commission Chair Fran Ulmer is the moderator. She starts us off.
Good afternoon, everyone. Your Majesty, Mr. Ambassador, and all of our distinguished guests from Norway and fellow Alaskans, this is indeed a great honor for all of us to be able to take a moment to reflect on the many ways in which Norway and the United States have been partners, friends, allies, and collaborators over many, many years. The Arctic is a very special place. It is both valuable and vulnerable. And it is a place that those of us who are fortunate enough to live in the Arctic or the near Arctic consider a magical place. If we reflect upon the many ways in which Norway and Alaska are the same, we can see how much we really share. Northern lights, the midnight sun, the polar night, fishing, tourism, oil and gas, indigenous people, the Sami in Norway, well respected and part of their vibrant communities. There are some ways in which we differ. Norway has trolls and Vikings and an oil fund that's more than 10 times the size of the permanent fund. They have the highest per capita utilization of electric cars and rely on hydroelectricity. And as I learned when I served on the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Commission, they have an excellent method of controlling risk in their oil and gas industry through their performance-based regulatory system. There is much that we can learn from Norway, and I believe much that Norway can learn from us. And that is why events like this one, and the many associated events that are happening this week because of the King's visit, enables us to take a moment to reflect on what our stewardship obligations are toward this special place we call home, the magical Arctic. It is my great pleasure and honor to invite Your Majesty to the stage to provide remarks and to provide for all of us an opportunity to more completely understand Norway and to think about how we might work together as partners in the future. Thank you very much, Your Majesty.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for the warm welcome I have received here in Alaska, and it feels very much like coming home. Both Norwegians and Alaskans are peoples of the North. Perhaps this is why we share several characteristics: our respect for nature, our love for the outdoors, and the fact that we never, ever complain about the weather. I mean, there's no reason to. Look outside, it's perfect. The world is increasingly looking to the North. The US has recently taken over the chairmanship of the Arctic Council. Climate change and increased human activities are making this body more relevant than ever. It is Alaska that makes the U.S. an Arctic nation. The knowledge and experience of the people of this state have been forged through centuries of toil at the northern tip of the American continent. Your voice is an important and necessary guide for your great nation in its approach to the Arctic. A common history and shared values have created strong bonds between U.S. and Norway. I will never forget our heartfelt welcome by the American people when my family was forced to flee Norway during the Second World War and came to the United States, where I stayed for 5 years. My family were not the only Norwegians to look to America for safety and a better life. Many of you are here because your ancestors moved to America. Your presence here today is testimony to our shared traditions and cultural heritage. Norwegian polar explorers also ventured to the U.S. Roald Amundsen's ship Gjøa reached Nome, Alaska in August 1906. He and his crew became the first to cross the Northwest Passage after spending 3 years in the ice. Later, he would be the first person to reach the South Pole in 1911, before returning to Alaska in 1926 after crossing the North Pole by airship. He thereby became the first person to have been to both poles. In February this year, I visited Antarctica for the 10th anniversary of the Norwegian research station Troll. And last month, Crown Prince Haakon and Crown Princess Mette Marit visited the Norwegian research vessel Lance, which is currently drifting in the Arctic ice in a similar way to Fridtjof Nansen's vessel Fram. Research and reliable data is essential in our struggle against climate change. The projects at the poles give us valuable knowledge in finding solutions to one of the greatest challenges of our time. As you can understand, this has been an active polar spring for me and my family. Now I am happy to be here today to open this conference on how Alaska and Norway can promote Arctic knowledge together. Knowledge must be our guiding light as we seek to address our shared challenges. Unless we increase our knowledge, we will never deepen our understanding of the complexity of the region. Roald Amundsen once said that, I quote, "Victory awaits him who has everything in order. Luck, people call it. Defeat is certain for him who has neglected to take the necessary precautions in time. This is called bad luck." To the experts who will speak after me at this luncheon and at the round table discussion after lunch, I would like to say, take Amundsen's advice seriously. Let no stone be left unturned as you seek to increase our understanding about the Arctic. Work hard, be well prepared, and you will have, as Amundsen put it, good luck. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Majesty, and thank you particularly for putting an emphasis on the importance of science and research and knowledge that are essential for both the public-private sectors to really make good decisions. We have a panel of three distinguished speakers who will address the question of what is the Arctic and what is our role in the Arctic from a policy perspective, an exploration perspective, and a science perspective. What is the Arctic? To many different people, it is many different things. For some, it is a garden that has sustained their families and their ancestors for generations. For others, it is a place of exploration, adventure. For some, it is an opportunity for a different kind of future. And for some, it is just dark and dangerous and cold, and they can't imagine ever going there. The Arctic is many different things. Our three panelists will address the issue of how can we break through some of the myths and misconceptions about the Arctic and help those who have never experienced it and know little about it to be curious enough to learn more about the Arctic. Craig Fleener, followed by Harold Steen, followed by Birger Östlund. Craig, may I ask you to come forward? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and to the King and to our Norwegian colleagues that came from such a tremendous distance to visit us in Alaska, I welcome you and thank you very much for coming to my home and spending some time with us. And before I get started, I just have to say, if Admiral Papp, who I hold in high regard and as a very well-traveled man, thinks that he's humbled by who he got to be the opening speaker for, imagine me. I come from a small village of about 550 people, a place called Fort Yukon, 8 miles north of the Arctic Circle, a place that's the coldest and the warmest in the state of Alaska, a place with 6 months of winter, with northern lights dancing across the sky, with fields, meadows, with timber, with spruce trees. We harvest moose and caribou and ducks and geese and rabbits and squirrels and cranes and swans and owls. And I could go on for days on what we harvest. The importance of that place to me is exactly what Lieutenant Governor Ulmer just said. It is a garden. It's exactly what we needed, what my people needed to sustain themselves for thousands of years. Everything that we got from the place around us. We couldn't go somewhere else to get it. We had to get it from where we were. It was also a place that was dark and harsh and tough and terrible and also beautiful at the same time. Well, that's my home. Many of you have been to places like Fort Yukon. Many of you have been to places in Norway that are very similar to Fort Yukon, except maybe I don't think they get 84 below zero. But other than that, a lot, maybe in Svalbard. But it is a beautiful place. It's a challenging place. It's a wonderful place. And the reason that I give you that image of what Fort Yukon is because I think one of the greatest things that's been missing in the entire message about what the Arctic is, the message that we need to get out to the world is that we need to humanize the Arctic. We need to put a face on the Arctic. You can put my face on it, and if I don't look good enough, you can put someone else's face on it. Put your own face on it. Tell your story about the Arctic. Why is it important to you? How are we going to take care of the Arctic? How are we going to use the Arctic to our advantage? What is the Arctic going to be today and tomorrow and forever? And those are the things that we need to consider. Those are the stories that we need to tell the people around the country, the people around the state, and the people around the world. Because if we don't put a human face on what the Arctic is, then folks will continue to not understand it. They'll continue to think of it as a frozen block of ice where people don't live and it's not important. But those of us from Alaska know that that's not the case. Those of us from Alaska know that this is a vitally important place that's important to us. It's important to the world. And I wish I had the speech memorized that my dear friend, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell gives, because he has a very nice long laundry list of the things that the Arctic provides to the world. And they're critically important things. I just wish I could remember them right now, but I can't. So I'll go on to my speech. The need for Arctic leadership in Alaska, the U.S., and the world is an imperative that can no longer be ignored. With catastrophes like coastal erosion caused by storm surges that destroy communities, with potential benefits like reduced shipping costs for the world, with fears such as extreme weather never before seen, with the benefits of huge potential oil and gas and mineral wealth that are yet untapped, with growing concerns about building and expanding military presence in the North, and with the promise of more access, more resources, more wealth, and more stability, where do we stand? As Northerners, what's next? I think this is why we're here today, and this is why we come together to these sorts of events, is to talk about this. Where do we stand? What's next? I've long argued that in order to draw attention to the needs of Alaska, we need a national imperative. And I'm happy that the Admiral touched on a component of a national imperative. There are probably a number of issues that could make the Arctic a national imperative. And really, I think nearly all of the major events in Alaska that propelled us into the developed place that we are today came from national imperatives. I think the building of the Alcan came because of the national imperative of World War II. The building up of Arctic infrastructure, including roads and the military infrastructure, came because of the Cold War. The building of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline came about because of the national imperative of energy security. But what will our new imperative be? Is it climate change? Is it a safe Arctic? Is it a free Arctic? I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know that we need a national imperative if we're going to turn attention to the Arctic, especially the U.S. version of the Arctic, because I think we're the least understood places in the Arctic, and I think that we need a national imperative. I believe in order to create that lasting imperative, beneficial Arctic policy for the Arctic, we have to work together. And I think that's probably the first step to a good national imperative is us working together, doing the best job we can. We can do it through the Arctic Council. We can do it through other events such as this one. But we have to work together. We need a unified approach to what we're going to do in the Arctic. We need a unified approach to security, to safety, to energy development, to food security, to disaster preparedness and response, to infrastructure. I've long said that together we can do what we cannot do alone. And certainly Alaska, the United States, Canada, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Greenland, none of the Arctic nations, none of the other nations on their own can take care of the Arctic in the way that it needs to be taken care of. And certainly we can't continue to meet the needs of the world without working together. So I think we must look together north. We must work together. We have to focus together. Because together we can do what we cannot do alone. We can have security and defense. The state of Alaska has put a tremendous amount of effort into identifying some of the imperatives, and they are security and defense. They're marine transportation, search and rescue capability, oil spill response, energy efficiency, wildlife and fisheries, all going back to the broader issues that I talked about earlier and identifying some of the important components of the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council, and also bringing together so much of what the Arctic Council has done to date. But I think more focus needs to be put on working together. And areas that we need to focus and put more effort on is that the idea of working together to solve our problems. I think too many times we focused individually as nations. Certainly Alaska is a very proud state, and we like to focus on issues ourselves. But I think if we work together, I think if we pull our collective brain power together, we can start to solve the problems that we have. I think if we pull our resources together, our human resources, our financial resources, to really dig down to the problems that we face, no matter what they are, you know the problems, I don't need to point them out. No matter what the problems are, if we work together in a broader perspective, I think we can do an awful lot to solve these problems. Really, I propose that we find a number of examples, create the synergies that are necessary to focus our investment, our time, and our energy to find the solutions to the problems that we have. The last thing I'll leave you with is, in the importance of Alaska, to me and to many of us in this room, as a component of the Arctic, we have to remember, we have to also get the word out that Alaska cannot be treated simply as a jewel or simply as something that needs to be set aside and put on a shelf. Alaska must be able to develop its resources. It must be able to generate an economy. We must be able to be self-supporting and stand alone. At the same time, we need to do exactly what's been talked about before. We need to research the issues that are out there. We need a better understanding of climate change and what those impacts are going to be, and we need to be involved in the decision making as we go forward. Alaska must be involved in decision making at the U.S. level, and we must be involved at the global level. And with that, I thank you very much, and I hope you have a very enjoyable day.
You just heard from the governor's advisor on Arctic policy, Craig Fleener. The next speaker is Harald Steen. Steen is the director of the Center for Ice, Climate, and Ecosystems at the Norwegian Polar Institute. Harald Steen.
Your Majesty, Mayor, Ambassador, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. I will speak of a project that I am so fortunate to be the leader of, which is a 6-month-long campaign where we have used our research vessel, the Lance, as we call it in Norwegian, Lance, and froze her into the ice north of Spitsbergen and let her drift there and house researchers so they can collect data during the winter time. I will first give you a little background of why we're doing this. And the Arctic is losing ice in a very, very rapid rate. We are losing about 40% in the last 4 decades. Why that is important, just the mere cover of the ice, is because of the warm water or the ocean. It leaks, or energy is transferred to the atmosphere, and it heats the atmosphere above the Arctic. The jet streams start going slower, and you get longer lasting weather, and you get more extremes. So there are reason to believe that we should keep the protecting lid of the ice on the poles. Not just the ice is also thinning in the Arctic. This data is from a campaign we had since the 1990s, where we have a row of ocean observatories that are having something funny as an upward-looking sonar, which actually look from below and look at the ice thickness. And we see here that in the 1990s, it was 3.5 meters thick, while now it is below 2 meters. The difference is that in the 1990s, majority of it was multi-year ice, and now it is first-year ice. First-year ice is different. It absorbs more energy. It disappears faster, it drifts faster, it breaks apart faster, so it's a completely different ice. Our models does not incorporate that. So combining this, that we are both losing ice area, but we are losing ice volume, which is a quite serious matter. Ability. Our ability to understand the world is reflected in our way to model it. This figure here shows the blue line being the old models of the sea ice disappearance. The red line is the improved models, and the black line is the reality. And we see just the slope of the curves that we do not gimmick reality very well. And the reason for this is not that we don't understand why ice freezes and melts. It is more that we don't understand the underlying ocean currents and the atmospheric forcing of the system. And that is kind of the background of the project that I started. The starting slide, the Norwegian Young Sea Ice Group. Young Sea Ice Groups. We, Our aim is to understand the young sea ice from cradle to grave, i.e. from when it freezes in the fall, in the wintertime, until it melts. We want to understand how the ice is affected by the currents coming in, and how it's melted from below, and how it is losing energy in the winter and freeze, and then it receives energy when the sun comes back. All this is an energy balance, which actually then is the makeup of the freezing and thawing. We also want to look at how the thinner ice moves and how it drifts. This will be important for both how it melts and also how ships can navigate through it. And ultimately, we also want to look at the biology and how the conditions are changing. Where are we in the world? We are in the middle of the square, the yellow square there. North of Spitsbergen, which is again far, far, far north of northern Norway. We are talking about 83 degrees north. And closing in a little bit here and make it a little bit bigger and show you some more explanations. This is a very, very special area because we have the Gulf Stream that comes up, follows shelf edge, and then it wears off to the east and dives under the ice or the Arctic water masses above Spitsbergen. That creates an open area of ice way out in the wintertime, and it's also historically it was where the Whalers Bay was in that region where they did the earliest whaling. This water is warm, 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees. It stays down below 50, 100 meters, but in certain circumstances, which we believe it is more of now, and with more open water, that happens more often, it is drawn to the surface, i.e. we are getting a warmer surface water. And that's not very good for ice melt. When we were planning this project, we are so fortunate as Norwegians that we are standing on the shoulders of giants, not just Amundsen, which taught us that we need to be very well prepared. We also stand on the shoulders of Nansen. You may know Nansen as an explorer that crossed the Greenland inland ice. He drifted over, seen in the red path there, over the Arctic. And then went for a dash for the pole. He never reached it. He ended up spending a winter together with another guy in a stone hut and sharing a sleeping bag. And they all came out, and he did a lot of things after that. But what you maybe not know about Nansen is that he is a very distinguished scientist. In 1888, he defended his PhD on the nervous system of hagfish. That because they have very large nerves, they are very good. That was just when they were looking at it in microscopes and they were looking for the synopsis, or basically how it worked. So that was his background. He's a keen scientist. And he was in Bergen, that was where he was educated. And that's where, you can say, we say the cradle of at least Norwegian meteorology. And they thought that the ocean was the answer. So he was trained also as an oceanographer. So a lot of his drift across the pole was, as a matter of fact, scientifically funded. And so they ran CTDs with this Nansen water sampler, as it is still called, and they discovered that it was a deep ocean, and they discovered the major currents underneath there, and they, So he was driven by his quest, and we with ours, which how the climate is changing this area. But to do that, he then got the Fram built, and it was constructed by Colin Archer, and he found a way, a hull shape that was pushed up by the ice and not pushed down when the forces set in. And so we have our ship, Lanse, and here's a little bit of a movie when we are getting into the ice, helped by the Norwegian Coast Guard, Svalbard.
Steen plays a video here showing some of the science that happens aboard the RV Lanse. If you want to see it, it's linked to on our website, alaskapublic.org. Scroll down and look for the Addressing Alaskans icon in the middle of the page.
Another warm day in the Arctic.
Another warm day, yeah.
Minus 27 and light winds for the day in the office.
So this were some films that we took while we were in the beginning of the expedition when we froze the Lanse into the ice. I was the cruise leader at that time, and it was quite a special journey, I'll say. It was quite the feeling when we saw the Coast Guard after escorting us in for 180 nautical miles up into the ice and just see her disappearing, and you knew that you were just alone. The boat housed us very well and served us very well, and we were doing all our science, everything gone according to plan. My crew is a little bit luckier than Nansen's crew was, because they had to stay there for about 3 years. We have cruise shifts on this to the ship about every six to three weeks. 6 weeks in the beginning and 3 weeks now later, and it's done by our search and rescue helicopters that's stationed in Longyearbyen. And one of the pilots told me that, Harold, you got to know this is not all of us that really want to do this, because we are heading out in the ice to something that we don't really know too much about. And we are working at the maximum distance of what we can do. And we had some very good cooperation with our Coast Guard, which have used as a refueling point, etc. We also have refuelings on the northern part of Spitsbergen. So we have had also, as a matter of quite realistic training on how to move people in and out of a vessel way north, way up in the north. This is a little film piece of some ice dynamics. That's 7 miles across this picture, and the ridges, or the white lines you see there, is ridges. And here comes a storm, and the boat is in the center. It's quite dramatic forces, and it was quite dramatic on board. This happened during the night, and the ice started coming in, and the skipper, he woke up everybody and made them ready to start to shovel ice. But as Colin Archer taught the shipbuilders, that if you just do it right, it will go under.
and all of a sudden this started to go under, and this 3,000 metric ton ship was lifted 1 meter straight up, or 3 feet, within quite short time. And she stayed there for 2 weeks. She didn't kind of sink down again. So she was stuck, literally, although the ice around her was gone pretty much. We had some very nice collaborations with the US. We have had people on board from different organizations, but we also had a NASA ice bridge project where they took their C-130 from Thule, took off from there and flew all the way over Greenland, all the way over to us. And you can't see it on this picture, but there's a dotted two dotted lines there where they did two passes, low passes over there, where they ran all their instruments. And we, after they've been there, we ran out there and we ground truthed the whole area so they can learn more about their instruments and they get a ground truthing of how it really is where they are observing. So that's an example of some of our international corporate. This picture is taken from the C-130. We also had some visits. We had the Crown Prince and Crown Princess of Norway visiting us. Here they are chatting with one of our divers, or it's a scientist. He had stayed for about 1.5 hours there, so he was pretty cold at that point. We had also our minister visiting us. And we were so lucky to have four 13-year-old kids that was to be educated as Arctic explorers and scientists. They were a very, very fun bunch to be around, and and hopefully they will continue their quest into science and in the North. Yeah. Here's my last slide of an onset, and kind of a little bit different from when it's dark. This is taken from one of the helicopters that came in with the media. If there should be, or there is, there was people from National Geographic that joined us, and they will make some an issue where we will be one of the stories. And BBC had been there, and the numerous of others have been giving us this coverage. We have area. We have seven different countries that are up there, amongst them Russia, France, Germany, Canada, U.S., and doing both their own project and participating in our projects. So, and at last, as we are discussing in the expert panel, that data sharing. This project has a very open data policy, so we hope that we can provide the world with more and better data from this new young CI system. Thank you.
That was Harald Steen of the Norwegian Polar Institute. Our next speaker is polar explorer and adventurer Børge Usland.
Your Majesty, Excellences, distinguished guests. 4 days ago, me and a French explorer called Vincent Colliard returned to civilization after crossing the Stikine ice field here in Alaska. And my God, what a place. We struggled really hard just to get onto the glacier, and not to mention the troubles we had getting off the glacier. We dragged our sled through numerous ice falls. We trekked through dense forest. We paddled out from the glaciers in our small pack raft until we finally reached the Stikine River at the very end of our rations. I've been crossing many glaciers in the world, but there is few places I've been to that has been so beautiful and stunning as here in Alaska. If I was American, I would for sure be living here with all these possibilities for expeditions and outdoor activities. And the landscape actually reminds me a little bit of Norway, even though the scale is smaller and the mountains are not quite high. There are similarities. And one thing we have in common is the Arctic, where I spend most of my career as an adventurer. I grew up being inspired by the great polar explorers like Nansen and Roald Amundsen, but it took many years before I finally could go to this mythical north, until 1986, when I crossed the Greenland ice cap with two friends. But from then on, my heart and soul was lost to the polar regions. And since 1994, when I did the first solo and unsupported ski expedition to the North Pole, I've been a full-time polar explorer, where adventure and pushing the limits of human endurance has been the driving force. In 1995, I did a solo trek to the South Pole, and in 1997, I crossed the whole Antarctica from one coast to the other, solo and supported, another classical first, followed by a solo crossing of the Arctic Ocean, which I did from Siberia to Canada via the North Pole in 2001. Now, you shouldn't think that these huge solo treks across the poles would be any kind of fun, really. After all, it's a quite serious undertaking. But there are moments, and when I did the solo trip across the North Pole, I suddenly stumbled upon this wooden log. And for you guys who see trees and poles every day, this is like nothing. But for me, who'd seen just snow and ice for weeks, this was just like Disneyland. But that is nothing compared to what happened when I reached the North Pole. And when I reached the North Pole, I was halfway, and that's always been a magical point for me. If I managed to do half the trip, I would probably also manage to do the rest of the trip. So I was in my tent celebrating, obviously alone, when I suddenly heard helicopter. And I thought, helicopter at the North Pole, what's happening? I got out of my tent, the helicopter landed just near my campsite, and out of the helicopter came a real Arabic sheikh.
How are you?
I'm very pleased to meet you, and I heard very nice that you have been traveling from Siberia to going to Canada.
Canada, yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Yes, very
and
nice.
How long it will be? 4.5 months?
No, not that much. For me?
Yeah.
Yes.
No, you start 2 months ago.
Yeah, 2 months ago.
And you need 1.5 months?
Yeah, so 3.5 months.
Yeah, 3.5 months. It's a lot of, yeah.
Yes, it's, it is. Yeah.
It's a huge. It's a huge.
For me, I have been here only 30 minutes now.
Yeah. I've been 52 days alone.
Alone?
Mm-hmm.
Good luck. Yeah. That really is something great, you know, I hear.
You want to take a picture with us?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Yes, I would like.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you very much. It is our honor, pleasure to take a picture. Yes.
By now, you know where to go if you want to see that video for yourself. Børge Uslan meeting a sheikh near the North Pole. Find it at alaskapublic.org. We also have a link to Uslan's YouTube channel, which I highly recommend if you have an afternoon to kill. He has some pretty amazing stuff. Back to Uslan.
After that, I took actually a big leap into the unknown and went for another trek to the North Pole, but this time during the winter, in the dark period. I did this together with South African explorer Mike Horn. And this is probably the most difficult trip I've done, at least physically. We swam across open leads in these specially made dry suits. We fight the intense cold during the polar night. But it was also probably the most beautiful trip I've done, and especially when we had this full moon and could see a little bit of the area around us, and it was just like really being on a different planet. We managed to pull it off, barely, and we did it because we took care of each other. And on a trip like this, there are so much things that can go wrong. You have to do that because you can't watch your friends back if you're just thinking about yourself. In 2007, I went back to the North Pole, this time together with Swiss explorer Thomas Ulrich, where we wanted to follow in the great heroes, Fridtjof Nansen and Hjalmar Johansen's footsteps through Franz Josef Land. And we started at the North Pole 1st of May and headed south across the Arctic Ocean until we came to Franz Josef Land, where we paddled in our small kayaks through this archipelago, which is a part of the Russian Arctic. And we managed to locate the remains of Nansen and Johansen's winter camp at Cape Norvegia. Here, these two guys, they were forced to spend the winter. They dug into the ground and just lived off the land. And I think this wintering they did between 1895 and 96 is really one of the most remarkable survival histories of the Arctic. On that trip, they ate 19 polar bears. Those bones I hold in my hands here is actually reminds of the bones that these two guys chewed on during that that winter. We continued, and when we came to Cape Flora, which is one of the southernmost islands on Franz Josef Land, we pulled the kayaks up on the beach, we set up camp to wait for the sailboat that was going to pick us up. And at this stage, Thomas and I, we'd been on this trip together for more than 3 months, just the two of us. And you know that when you've been on such a long expedition with so few impulses from the outside, you do become a little bit simple-headed. But then again, you only get as much fun as you can get yourself. But this is nothing compared to what happened when we met these guys.
Ja, Børge, hva skjer?
Ja, det århundres overraskelse. Plutselig så var det en svær båt her ute. Expedition.
Hello.
You have the documents?
Hello.
Hello.
Visa там все. Uh-huh. Смотри, я Виктора Боярского, но по Боярскому доступно.
Как я был?
Российская виза есть?
Техболт импорт. Все, без ограничений.
Все, оставляй, нормально.
Сейчас я.
А второй?
Да, пересними.
Take picture? Второй показал.
Можно ли снимать?
Можно, конечно.
Ja, ja, ja. Så kom verden til oss da, litt tidligere enn venta. Men nå suser det rundt med masse turister her.
That's good.
So,
where are you from?
Who are you?
Hello there.
Hello.
I'm Gretchen. This is Bob. We're from Los Angeles.
Hello. Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing here?
We've come to see you.
Did you know that you're the first people we've seen in 3 months?
You're kidding.
Yeah, our expedition is finished here.
Mm-hmm. Where did you start from?
We are a bit earlier than we planned.
North Pole.
So we have to wait another
pole.
Week.
Yeah.
And in your kayak?
Yeah.
I tell you, that was a big shock. Gradually, I also became more and more involved in the environmental side of the Arctic, and especially the changes we're facing now. Harald mentioned that the sea ice is thinning, and I've seen it with my own eyes from the first expedition in 1990, when the thickness of the Arctic pack ice was three meter or more. Now it's 2 meter, so it's a reduction of 30%. And the process is easy to explain. This white surface of the snow and ice reflects most of the energy back to space, and when that is replaced with open water or vegetation or whatever, the dark surface of the water absorbs the energy, and this process is one of the main reasons why the temperature in the Arctic rises twice as fast as the global average. In 2007 was a very special year when it came to the ice coverage on the Arctic Ocean. It hadn't been measured so little ice in the Arctic since the measurement started in the late 1970s. And both the Northeast and the Northwest Passage was open at the same time. And that is when I got the idea that it might be possible to sail around the Arctic in one short summer season. And after 3 years of planning, we set sail with this small fiberglass trimaran and a 10-horsepower outboard engine. This boat is named Northern Passage. And we started from Oslo, Norway, sailed up along the coast of Norway through the Northeast Passage first, which is on the northern coast of Russia, across the Bering Strait to Point Barrow in Alaska, and then through the Northwest Passage and south of Greenland and back to Norway in only 4 months. And this was the first circumnavigation of the Arctic in one summer season. And the reason we did this trip was to be that visual example to show what is happening with the pack ice in the Arctic. And if we could do a trip with such a small raft in 4 months, that would have taken maybe 6 years in Amundsen's time. Amundsen used 3 years to sail through the Northwest Passage with Gjøa, and he used 3 years to sail through the Northeast Passage with Maud, so with 6 years in total. So if we could do this in just a few months with such a small craft, I think that's a clear and visual example on what is happening with the drift ice in the Arctic. And climate change is happening now. It's not something that's happening in the future. And the pack ice and the melting of the glaciers is really the first clear example of that. And that takes me back to why I'm here in Alaska, crossing the Stikine ice field. Vincent and I, we have a project called the Ice Legacy. And the main reason for this project is to cross the 20 greatest glaciers, ice caps in the world. And we do this mainly for two reasons. One is that we want to inspire people to get out in the outdoors more often. And I think that that's a huge benefit on an individual level. And I think also this is one of the most important anchors and traditions we can hand over to our kids. But more importantly, it's also to highlight the importance of how important glaciers are for the climate on Earth. Again, the white surface reflects the energy back to space, and they have a stabilizing effect on the climate, but they are very vulnerable, just that light gray color of a small feather is enough to attract heat, which speed up the melt process. And everyone knows that in the end of the day, a melting glacier will end up in the ocean and contribute to sea level rise. And almost all the glaciers on the northern hemisphere, they are shrinking. We do this project together with National Geographic Society in Washington. We do not really expect to make any headlines with this project, but if we can inspire people to get more into the outdoors more importantly, understand and act on climate change, if it helps just a drop, it's worth all the hardship and the struggle. So next year, we will be back to cross St. Elias, which is one of the biggest glaciers in the world, actually the biggest glacier, non-polar glacier in the world. So what more can I say? We really look forward to getting back to stunning Alaska next year. Thank you very much.
That was Norwegian explorer Børge Ousland, you just heard from. U.S. Arctic Research Commission Chair Fran Ulmer offers some closing remarks.
Thanks to our three excellent panelists who gave us much food for thought and inspired us to go on some adventures. I'm not sure we'll go on those adventures, but some adventures. So we have now begun the part of the program where we are going to have table conversation. And I'm going to pose two questions to start you in your conversation. But before I pose those two questions, I would like to make two brief suggestions. One is to visit the Anchorage Museum, where today the King opened a new exhibit, the Polar Night Exhibit, which comes from Tromsø, Norway, and it is a beautiful example of exploration in the polar night. You get your flashlight at the door, the room is darkened, and you shine a light on each of the exhibits, sort of mimicking what it would be like to be a polar night adventurer. And you learn about what the sea creatures are doing during the long polar night. So I hope you will go to the Anchorage Museum and see that exhibit. It is excellent. I saw it in Tromsø back in January, and the Anchorage Museum and the Tromsø Museum have really provided an excellent link between adventure and science. And secondly, I would like to suggest to those of you who would like to, on a continuing basis, stay in touch with what is happening in the Arctic, not just in our part of the Arctic, but the Arctic at large. If you go to arctic.gov, www.arctic.gov, you can sign up for something called the Daily Update, which will every day tell you a little bit about what is happening in the Arctic, Arctic science, Arctic policy, Arctic governmental decisions that are being issued, and Arctic meetings. So those are the two things I would suggest to you. So the questions that I would urge you to discuss at your table, among others that you may wish to do, number one, what kinds of partnerships occur to you as being appropriate for not only the U.S. and Norway, but perhaps more specifically, Alaska and Norway? As you may know, Tromsø and Anchorage are sister cities. That's one thing that we might want to build on. The University of Tromsø and UAA will sign an agreement this afternoon. That's one thing we might build on. Talk about what opportunities you are aware of or that you might be able to help with. And the second question I'd like you to discuss is, what can we as Alaskans do to reach out to people, friends, relatives, et cetera, who don't live in Alaska, to help educate them about the Arctic, about its challenges, its opportunities, and our responsibilities toward the Arctic? What can you do? What can we do so that more Americans understand how important this region really is? So with that, one more time, let's thank all of our speakers, and thank you all for being here today.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. You heard from King Harald V of Norway at the top of the hour, followed by Arctic advisor Craig Kleiner. Climate researcher Harald Steen and polar adventurer Børge Usland rounded out the hour. U.S. Arctic Commission Chair Fran Ulmer provided the concluding remarks. This panel was recorded May 27th at the Dena'ina Center. It was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. We had production help this week from Hannah Craig and Eric Keto. Until next week, I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.